Okay, the meeting will come to order. And first order of business will be the Department of Revenue presentation on the mandated property tax reports. And we'll start with the Code of Conduct for Appraisers. Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And with me today for the presentation on the Code of Conduct is to my left is Keith Albertson. He's the county assessor at in Douglas, and he's also the chair of the State Board of Assessors. And John Hagan, who is heads up our Education Information Unit in the at the Department of Revenue for in the Property Tax Division. Mr. Chair, as you indicated, that today we're here to present an overview of the Code of Conduct report that was mandated by the legislature to us last session. In addition, we will give you an overview of the Woodlands Classification report that was also mandated. And in addition, as we move forward during this session, we will also be able to present to you the mandated report on resorts, maybe as early as next week if the committee gets to it at that point. And then later in the month, we will be prepared to talk about some of the issues and recommendations with ag value and green acres. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hagan to begin an overview of the Code of Conduct. Or is it?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, my name is John Hagan. I'm the manager of the Information Education section of the Department of Revenue. And we're going to present to you, first of all, the Code of Conduct. First of all, I'd like to remind you, I guess, that taxes are very unpopular. And when something is unpopular, such as taxes, it's prone to a lot of complaints, as it is with the property taxes. At the Department of Revenue, we receive questions and complaints concerning assessors and the assessment routinely, by the week, or more often even. Complaints range from the assessor has him valued too high to the assessor has him valued all right, but a friend or a relative, usually a brother-in-law, is valued too low. Do they have to allow the assessor into the house? The assessor won't give him homestead, or the assessor is giving homestead improperly to somebody. But conversely, the assessor is giving preferential treatment, or the assessor has it into that individual. Which is not to say that there aren't legitimate complaints. In my personal career, I've dealt with complaints that centered on preferential treatment of the County Board of Commissioners, illegally acquiring tax-forfeited lands by a county assessor, improperly withholding open space or other classifications, improper forging documents, and intentionally undervaluing property. Some of those investigations have led to resignations and even court actions. As legislators, you receive a lot of the same complaints and a lot of them get passed on to the department. As you know, many of the complaints can be easily explained, but sometimes they can't be, and occasionally they cross the line and require some sort of a disciplinary action by the Department of Revenue or some other authority. Last year, we were meeting with some legislators, and there was some amazement expressed that there was no formal code of conduct guiding or requiring assessors to conform to certain conduct requirements. So the 2005 legislature required that the Commissioner of Revenue to develop a code of conduct for presentation to the State Board of Assessors. The Department of Revenue organized a meeting with set up a code of conduct with the State Board of Assessors, working with the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. The committee designed to work on a code of conduct included two township assessors, two city assessors, two members from the State Board of Assessors, three representatives of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And our goal was to develop a code of conduct and ethics that was simple, straightforward, and succinct. The recommended code was reviewed by the Department of Revenue legal staff, and it was presented to the State Board of Assessors on December 6, 2005 for adoption. The State Board of Assessors did adopt it, and it effective March 1, 2006, the State Board of Assessors adopted the code of conduct, which Mr. Albertson, the chairman of the State Board, will explain.
Mr. Albertson.
Good morning. Just a little background about myself. I've been the Douglas County Assessor 17 years, 28 years in the profession. I've been on the State Board for 12 years, seven of those as chairman. So The board itself...
Mr. Albertson, how well does that pay?
Probably about, not as well as this, probably.
Being on the board?
We get expenses.
Well, thank you for your service. Continue.
Thank you. There are 9 members on the board. 2 of them are county assessor members, 2 are from the Department of Revenue, 2 local assessors, traditionally a city and a township assessor. The 1 public member who has an appraisal designation, that makes up the board. We meet probably about every other month throughout the year. The criteria, the board mainly establishes criteria for the 4 different designations assessors have throughout the state. And we grant designations based on those criteria. We review courses that are being offered for continuing education that's required. And the board does have the authority to refuse to renew, to suspend, or revoke an assessor's license. There's not a very long list of those issues that we would do that for, or a failure to complete required training, inefficiency, neglect of duty, unprofessional conduct, or any other cause or act in the board's opinion warrants refusal to grant the license. The code of conduct, there was one that existed before in the education licensing manual, but it was there only as a guide. It was not something that the board officially adopted. There was no requirements that it be adhered to. With the existing code being adopted now, that will be required on the license applications and renewals that the individual signs that they will adhere to the new code of conduct. The biggest change in that code is the prohibition against assessing one's own property or that of one's parents or children. That's the only real major departure from what existed as a guideline before. Throughout the state, I don't know necessarily that's going to have a huge impact. It'll have some impact because it'll cause some shifting of responsibilities around. Other than that, I don't know that's going to be a major burden on any district to have to comply with that regulation.
Okay, thank you. I believe we have a quorum, so we're going to approve the minutes. And the first one that I have here is the April 29th meeting. Representative Marquardt moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. April 29th. The next one is the Fairmont meeting on the November 30th. Representative Lynchesky would move approval of those meeting minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. And the third one would be the December 6th meeting in Forest Lake. Representative Simpson moves adoption of or approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you. Did you have anything else in your presentation, Mr. Albertson? Or?
Briefly, yes. In the past 5 years, we've actually suspended a license on 3 occasions. One of them was for an unpaid tax liability, one was due to unpaid child support, and one was due to doing fee appraisals in the same district where the individual is employed as an assessor. So in terms of the number of complaints that we actually deal with that require some action, that number is relatively small. The code itself, again, it talks about, you have a copy of it before you, I assume, so I don't know if you want me to go through and read the thing to you.
What we have is, I believe, the summary page from the State Board of Assessors, and the code of conduct and ethics summary, is this from the department? Okay. Members have that. Those are the 2
Basically, it just says that the assessor is going to conduct themselves in a professional manner, be honest in their dealings with property owners, be diligent, do your duties to the best of your ability, avoid the appearance of a conflict of interest, even if one doesn't exist. And again, the one I spoke of, the prohibited assignments that didn't exist before was certain individuals whose property you cannot assess your district, not to use your position to get unwarranted privileges, not to claim professional qualifications you don't have, cooperate with the Department of Revenue and the State Board in an investigation, and report to the Department of Revenue any unethical practices or actions of the assessors. And again, it makes official something that was pretty much unofficial before.
So now it's official.
Now it's official.
Okay. Mr. Hagan, did you have some comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In addition to the Code of Conduct, there's a few statutory sites that regulate the actions of assessors. Minnesota Statute 273.05 provides that the city assessor may be terminated at any time by the town board, city council, on charges by the Commissioner of Revenue of inefficiency and neglect of duty. A second provision requires the Commissioner of Revenue may recommend to the State Board of Assessors a non-renewal, suspension, or revocation of an assessor's license. And a third statutory provision that was enacted just several years ago, 273.061 sub 1, provides the term of county assessor may be terminated by the Board of County Commissioners at any time on charges of malfeasance, misfeasance, or nonfeasance. Additionally, the 2005 legislation that required the Code of Conduct and Ethics also required the Department of Revenue to develop a course on teaching the Code of Conduct and Ethics to all assessors. We have incorporated that into a four-hour ethics seminar that will be taught around the state at various locations. It will be required to be taught to all assessors once every 4 years. So during their four-year licensing period, they'll have to attend this seminar. Additionally, the State Board of Assessors thought it was a good enough idea that they wanted us to include it within a course on assessment procedures and history, commonly known as Course A, that we teach, and it's required of all incoming assessors. So we'll also be incorporating that four-hour seminar into the one-week course known as Course A. So every entry-level assessor will receive the Code on Ethics, Code of Conduct and Ethics, and additionally will be presented to all licensed assessors on maximum intervals of once every 4 years. And that concludes our remarks, Mr. Chairman. Stand for questions.
Are there any questions from members at this point? Okay, I just have one. One of the comments in here is, will the need for standardization of assessments be included in this area, or is that on the... like the fourth paragraph down on the revenue sheet, it says professional conduct and the need for standardized assessment practices. Does that include as part of the ethics, or is that a... Representative Nelson.
Did you get a question or an answer to your question there yet? Or
no, there's still, I think they're looking at the...
Mr. Chairman, where is that? I apologize.
Oh, it's in the 2000, oh, that's already in the law. Well, I'm reading the Code of Ethics, Code of Conduct and Ethics Summary, and then it... Second to the last paragraph from the bottom, it just says the 2005 legislature also required that. And then about the middle of that, it says professional conduct and the need for standardized assessment practices. And I was wondering if those were, if that was related to the ethics, or if that was going to be, because that dealt with like the resorts and some of those issues.
Right, Mr. Chair, that will be focused on as a part of the ethics and code of conduct seminars, and we'll be addressing standardizing assessments through the State Board of Equalization and making recommendations in the other reports as well.
Okay, and then they'll have that seminar every 4 years. How long are you going to make them redo this? I've had to do it, but anyway, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hagan, Mr. Folkman, anybody there. On our sheet, Minnesota State Board of Assessors, the Code of Conduct and Ethics, item 2B on prohibited assignments. And if my memory serves me correctly, this kind of was a more than lukewarm issue when we had different constituents come in and testify before this committee over last year and that type of stuff. And so I'm wondering, what do we have as far as any type of, I don't know what the term would be, but an audit that they, in fact, are complying by, especially this part. And also then, if they're not, what's the recourse on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the code is just effective March 1, 2006, and very honestly, we've been working so hard on developing reports that we're sort of doing a lot of this in the fly. We have discussed briefly the need for having our regional reps develop an audit procedure to make certain that there's a listing of all relatives that assessors can't assess their property, and that will very probably become a part of our ongoing audit procedures. As far as the penalty for what happens, that's also developed. Mr. Fulton may want to even speak to that. Director Fulton has initiated actions for redeveloping
it's turned on.
Well,
Director Fulton has initiated plans where we're trying to develop an actual investigation policy. When we do and what we do in specific circumstances, and when it's a Department of Revenue problem or issue and a State Board of Assessors issue, and they do sort of overlap a little bit the responsibilities and the duties.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring that point up because, like I said, I think that was kind of the crux for a lot of the rest of it, both above and below that. And so, you know, in the year and years to come, we'll want to kind of keep an eye on that. Thank you.
Any other questions from members?
Yeah.
We got another one. Okay. Anyone in the audience care to testify relating to this issue? Okay. Well, everyone seems happy with this. It's a good start. Thank you. And so the next thing on here is the assessment and classification report, the Rural Woodlands.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next item on our agenda is to present to you an overview of our woodlands classification report. And to do that, to my far left here is Stephanie Nias. She's our lead worker, our lead person on the woodlands report. And she'll be presenting an overview of the issues and recommendations for you. And also to my immediate left is Mel Hentz. He's the county assessor for St. Louis County, and he is also here to talk a little bit about some of the issues in St. Louis County, which is a pretty good example of a lot of the classification issues that are that we have addressed in our report. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Nias.
Mr. Chairman, representatives of the committee, this report was developed as part of the legislation last year to look at the classification practices of assessors for rural woodland property and to make any recommendations on any clarifications that are needed. It was the result of a cooperative effort between the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division and seven county assessors. We also enlisted the participation of the Minnesota Forestry Association and the Minnesota Seasonal Recreation Property Owners. Basically, we're going to talk a little bit about the classification of improved property versus unimproved property. First off, assessors must classify improved property according to its actual use on the assessment date of January 2nd. Unimproved property, however, with no identifiable use, must be classified according to its most probable highest and best use. Highest and best use is typically an appraisal concept that governs the valuation of properties. It's not typically associated with determining the use or classification of a property for property tax purposes under 273.13. Under current law, there's a wide variety of legitimate potential classifications of unimproved property, each of which represent the property's highest and best use. In classifying unimproved property, assessors are required to use their professional judgment and develop the classification according to the property's most probable highest and best use. They are required to use their professional judgment and knowledge of the local market to anticipate how a property is most likely to be used. After considering such factors, such as the physical characteristics of the land, any zoning ordinances or building requirements in the area, the use of the surrounding properties, and the intended use of the subject property, if it is known, the assessor must choose the most probable use of the land that is physically possible, legally permissible, financially feasible, and maximally productive, which will generate the highest return for the land, and that is the highest and best use of the property. This translates into several possible classifications of vacant rural wooded land across the state. They can vary within a single county, across county lines, and they will vary across the state. There is not, unfortunately, just one correct answer to the classification of unimproved property. And as an example of that, Mel Hintz, the St. Louis County assessor, is going to explain some of the classifications that he uses in St. Louis County.
Good morning. My name is Mel Hintz. I'm the St. Louis County assessor. I've been an assessor since 1983. All of that time has been with St. Louis County. I'm currently the county assessor. If you catch me kind of peeking around the corner, it's because the representative on the committee from our county is hidden behind the chair. So if we were able to move the chair, I think I could have eye contact with everybody here.
Is he the one with the cell phone?
What I'd like to do is give you a little background on St. Louis County and then talk about a typical parcel in our county and some of the classifications that are used on those parcels so you can better understand the dilemma the assessor's often in classifying property. Just a little background on our county. Is a very diverse county. Ranges from Duluth on the south, which is, I believe, the second largest metro area in the state, to the Canadian border. And some of the playgrounds that people from this area come up to visit in terms of the Boundary Waters and Borgers National Park and so on. In between is the Iron Range, which traverses our county east to west from Babbitt to Hibbing. We have a number of prime lakes, like Lake Vermilion, Burnside, Cabotogama. It's a very large county. It's nearly 7,000 square miles. About 25 to 30% of it is publicly owned. And there's a lot of development pressure, and values are rising very rapidly. Years ago when I started with the county and I moved here from Colorado, I was amazed how cheap land was in St. Louis County. You buy a 40 for anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000. Now if you want to buy a 40, it's going to cost you anywhere from $30,000 to $120,000, depending upon where it's located. We have 105,000 taxable parcels. We have a lot of rural land. I think we have more trees than you have cars down here. And of our 105,000 taxable parcels, over 20,000 of them, about one-fifth, are rural land of one type or another. Parcels greater than 10 acres that are rural in character. I'd like you to think in terms of a typical rural parcel in St. Louis County. I'm going to walk through some of the classifications we'd use on that property, depending upon where it's located. A typical parcel in our county would have gravel road access. It'd have a mixture of trees from aspen to birch to perhaps some balsam, spruce. Might have a few pines mixed in. It's going to have gravel to rocky soils. It's going to be flat to slightly rolling. Some areas a little bit more rugged when you get up in the Ely area. And there's no improvements on it or really no signs of active use on the property. So just keep that thought in mind in terms of these five possible classifications that are out there that we use in our county. The first parcel that fits that very description is located just a few miles north of Duluth. The area around it is being developed into home sites. 40s are being divided into 10-acre parcels, and homes are being built. Properties of that type are classified as non-homestead residential. A few years ago, we went through And we've classified a number of properties in this very township, FME Lakewood Township, as non-homestead residential, and we filled the room with appellants because previously they had been at the timber class, and they recognized the tax consequences of going to non-homestead residential, and so they appealed to their local board for some relief. The local board did grant them the relief, but it did not document it correctly, and so that non-homestead classification did stay in place. The second parcel, again, with the same characteristics, is located in northern St. Louis County now, and it abuts public land, which we have an abundance of, abuts paper company land, and that property is classified as timber. And of our rural properties, 70% of those properties roughly will be classified as timber. Going back to non-homestead residential, that only represents 1%. And the reason for that is the properties that we classify as non-homestead residential that are vacant land fairly quickly become improved. And so the statistics I'm giving you represent unimproved properties. The third parcel, the third example, again, the same parcel, same characteristics. This time it's located a quarter mile from Lake Vermilion, where we're seeing a lot of second-tier development. And again, there's no evidence of use on it, but in this case we'd have it classified as seasonal, recreational, residential. The fourth example, again, same characteristics in terms of looking at this piece of land. It's located abutting one of our taconite mining companies, perhaps the tailings basin or their mine pit. That property would be classified as industrial, and we have nearly 1,500 parcels that are classified in that manner. And then the last parcel would be a 40...
Mr. Hintz, Representative Broad, you had a question?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I can wait till the last. It's regarding all the classifications.
Okay. Continue, Mr. Hintz.
The last example would be a parcel that is the second 40 in an 80-acre homestead. And it abuts that homestead, and so that parcel would be linked to the homestead and classed as residential homestead. All of these classifications result in different tax consequences. There's not one of them that gives you the same results. They either have different class rates, they have differences in terms of whether they're eligible for limited market value treatment, they have differences in terms of how the homestead credit behaves, and they have differences in terms of whether they're subject to the state general tax. And so when we have these classifications out there, it requires the assessor to use his professional judgment to decide where is the boundary between one class and another. Take the properties around, say the ones just north of Duluth, non-homestead residential. Where do you stop using that classification? Naturally, the person that's just on the wrong side of that line wants to talk to the assessor and appeal his classification. Same thing with the property around Lake Vermilion. If you use the quarter-mile ring and you classify those as seasonal, recreational, residential, that property that is a little bit further out that's classified timber, the person that's on seasonal, recreational, residential wants that same treatment because they want to escape the state general tax. So we're continually dealing with that issue. You factor in not only the requirement to handle those boundaries, but also to create some understanding among the taxpayers of how did you arrive at those boundaries. And if the taxpayer does not agree, their perception is that there's an inequity, some inequality or non-uniformity in the assessment. When we believe there's not, we try to do it to the best of our ability, but it's a tough sell sometimes.
So what you're saying is if we didn't have any taxes, we wouldn't have all these problems.
Well, and I wouldn't be here.
Representative Brett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's two things that are certain, and I think it's death and taxes, Mr. Chair. One of the questions, I guess, that comes to mind when you're talking about the different classifications is zoning. How do you account for zoning differences? Say, take those five. It would seem to me that if their zoning is different, that would create another variable in there for you.
The zoning in St. Louis County is fairly broad, which will allow a variety of uses. And I'm not an expert on zoning by any means, but in the more rural areas, They may require as much as 35 acres in order to put a structure on there. In other cases, it's 9.9 acres. But if you go through the class cases that I talked about, San Luis County would virtually allow any of those classifications because the use of that property would be permitted under zoning. The exception would be industrial, where the zoning does restrict residential use within industrial areas around the mining areas. But aside from that, you could take that 40, for example, that's next to Lake Vermilion. You could use that for non-homestead residential. You could use it for residential purposes. You could use it for seasonal purposes. So it doesn't, it's not definitive in terms of where you would draw your lines from a classification standpoint.
Representative Brown.
Thank you very much. It just seems to me that in an area, maybe not St. Louis County, but in an area of rather rapid growth, say a second or third ring donut around the suburban area, that zoning would be an important variable in valuation in terms of what people can do or can't do in terms of highest and best use. So I don't know if anybody else from the department has a viewpoint on that or how it measures in or how it fits in with classification.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, John Hagan, weighing on your question. And very definitely, zoning plays a big part in the highest and best use calculation, what's legally possible within that. A problem that we have that you're right on the edge of is the building potentials for various parcels. And we the Commissioner just wrote a letter to Representative Cox the other day concerning that very issue about moving TDRs, I believe, temporary development potentials from one property to another, consolidating them, holding them until they find a piece of property they want to put them on, which is a big problem. Another problem that is created is sometimes don't even have any zoning. So you have both ends of the spectrum where they're limited to 40-acre tracts or some, there's no restrictions whatsoever, but very definitely zoning plays a very big part in the valuation of property.
Thank you. Mr. Faulkman, could you just remind the committee where this came from? Because I don't think it was House Bill originally, and what the problems were that resulted in the study.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's my recollection that during the session last year, there was a lot of issues being brought forth to the legislature, most of which were being heard in this committee. I don't think there was as many issues or concerns being brought forth in the Senate. But I know that this committee was hearing all sorts of issues with respect to some of the classification inconsistencies that we were talking about here, issues pertaining to the Green Acres applications, issues referring to the different practices on resort valuation, 4D housing. There was a number of things that were in play. And I think it's my recollection that as a way to try and get a handle on this, during the, I don't know if it was just before the conference committee or during that time, it was sort of agreed upon between the department and the task committees that we try and develop these report requirements to try and identify these issues and tackle them one at a time, if you will. But it really was pointing out at the issue of trying to get our arms around a number of different assessment practices, issues that were out there, and put more emphasis on the uniformity of these practices, whether you're talking about ag values, resorts, or what have you. So this was a way to try and address the big picture of just uniformity and assessment practices, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. That's my memory.
Okay, thank you. Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, now, walk us through what the effective rates are on those five different classes.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Representative
Tom Zoney. No, I'm Rucavina. Well, I know us Rangers all look alike to you Duluth guys, but I'm the short one from five.
Okay, sir, can we get Tom Zoney?
Some are taller and shorter than others.
That's okay. That's okay, Mr. Epperly.
Okay, we're even. Mr. Chair, as far as the class rate, non-homestead residential is 1.25%. The timber classification is 1%. Seasonal recreational is 1% up to 500,000, and then over 500,000, it ratchets up to 1.25%. Industrial is two-tiered. It's help me. I think it's 1.5.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Representative, page 7 of the report is a little table with the classification rates.
If you wanted effective tax rate,
Yeah, but I don't think we have those computed.
No, there would be. It'd be different. And Mr. Chair, now, like at St. Louis County, how do you determine that a 40 that abuts a taconite plant it would be industrial when maybe it's just luck of the draw that somebody's old homestead 40 is there? Then do you take that into consideration and zone that seasonal rec or vacant or whatever? I mean, timber?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rubino, what we did is a number of years ago to bring equalization into the treatment of all the mining companies, and this is something actually I volunteered for when I started with the county, was to take a look at not only the valuation but the classification of all the mining lands countywide. And we went through a fairly extended process of meeting with the companies and honing a schedule that we use both for classification and valuation of mining company properties that is used across the range. And so it's blind ownership. It's if a private individual happened to own a 40 that abutted, say, a tailings basin, it would be classified as industrial unless it was part of their homestead. But typically the mining companies need to have that property under their control. And so it's really an unusual situation where you have a private individual owning a 40 where they hadn't at least leased it to the mining companies that was that close to the mining operation.
And, Mr. Chair, what happens in a situation, the members, what's happening up in St. Louis County now is, I believe, is it Potlatch that is leasing out? Potlatch has started to lease out all their property. And used to, I believe it was probably timber. And there was supposedly some unwritten rule by the Department of Revenue, remember, that it was open to public use because people used to hunt on it and everything else. Now they're leasing out 40s and 80s depending on where they're located. Have you reclassified all that land to seasonal rec property?
We have not done that, Mr. Chairman and Representative. In fact, Stephanie will cover that in more as we get into our report. That's one of the issues we did address in the report.
Well, and I haven't gotten to that part, but I'm curious as to why, because let me tell you, my cousin's property happens to abut one of those 40s, and he inquired because he really didn't, well, there's no access to this, absolutely no access, and he inquired with Potlatch then, well, how much do you want, because they actually sent memos to adjacent landowners, $1,000 a year. So they're making $1,000 a year restricting usage, and you're charging them timber. Or are you recommending something different in here?
Mr. Chairman, our recommendation on properties that are leased for hunting is that they would, actually we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, would not be changed to seasonal recreational. We would consider that an incidental use. That was part of the discussion we had as a committee.
Well, the reason I'm asking, Mr. Chair, members, is because I'm getting a lot of complaints from people who normally used to hunt in that and walk on this mm-hmm. property, and all of a sudden there's no trespassing signs going up all over the range where these properties are, all the way up to the Kuchiching border and that I know of in the Boundary Waters, and I don't think it's fair, really, that Potlatch should be given a break like that when they're making $1,000 on a 40 a year, and next door... in the case of my cousin next door, there's an 80 that's been in this family for 100 years where they use it for hunting, and they're paying seasonal rec.
Mr. Hagan,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rucavina. The reason the Potlatch lands used to be open to hunting was all those lands were part of the tree growth tax law, and a provision of the tree growth tax law was it had to be open to the public for hunting. Several years ago, we eliminated the tree growth tax law. The legislature eliminated the tree growth tax law. In its place, they put in the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act. And it was thought that all these companies would voluntarily go into the Sustainable Forest Program. And there's a provision in there within the Sustainable Forest Program. If an enrollee has over 1,920 acres, then their lands are also, by law, have to be open to public hunting. Potlatch chose not to do that. The other big landowners, Blandon and Boise and those big landowners all did go into the Sustainable Forest Program. Potlatch chose not to enter into it. for the very reason that they want to continue to try to lease the properties. They are presently exploring options, and we'll probably be approaching you about getting rid of that 1920-acre provision, whereby they could be within the Sustainable Forest Program and also restrict the hunting. With respect to your, that's the history of it. With respect to your specific question, and Ms. Nyquist will be getting into it later, we don't feel, and part of the problem we have here with the assessors is trying to determine what the actual classification of the property is based on the use or the highest and best use. And we consider, and it will be a part of our recommendation, that use of hunting, even though it's leased off for hunting purposes, is an incidental use to the overall management of the property in a case of the potlatch lands, which would constitute a timber classification.
Now, you know, Mr. Chair, I just really don't see the reasoning when they're making, you know, they've restricted the usage, and they're making a bunch of money off of it, and we're giving them a, you know, the sweetest property tax break that they can get under current law, and it doesn't seem right. And I'm getting a lot of complaints, so I'm looking forward to that meeting with them, because I'm going to go in the opposite direction if I can.
Representative Lynchewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, and I've heard you say a couple times you're going to get to it, but I'm interested in this as well, listening to Representative Rukavina. So is it effectively where you're going here, Representative Rukavina, and maybe you can help out here, is the tax cut really, or the tax break, is that potlatch would have to, if it was being taxed as unmined ore, it would have to pay state property tax, but because it's getting a timber classification, it's exempt from the state property tax? Is that what's taking place on those lands?
Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynchewski, if it was classed as seasonal recreational, it would be subject to the state general tax. I can't imagine, except on the, as Mr. Hintz alluded to, around the, on the buffer on the mines where it would be classed industrial. The only two real potentials for that type of classification, in my opinion, would be the timber class and or the seasonal recreational class, depending on under the current laws.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Mr. Chair, let's take your determination. You said if there's activity and there are signs on the property, you classified that property as seasonal rec property. So now we got signs going up on Potlatch's property. A matter of fact, I'll tell you how bad it's getting. There's a road that went down the middle of a 40 that a friend of mine was looking at to buy, and it was on the 40 line of Potlatch's property, and there were no trespassing signs on that road, even though that road technically belonged to both those 40s, because it was right down the property line. And so there's signs going up all over in the woods up there. And to me, then, it's not treating your constituency equitable, as your code of ethics said over here, by saying, you know, that, well, you guys can put up signs, I have no trespassing signs, and Potlatch, and you're going to pay, you know, this rate, and then the guy right on the other side of the road is going to place seasonal rec property in.
Mr. Hayden, yeah, I'm not sure I get this. Could you tell us, I mean, you're a little more familiar with it, but there must be some incentive for them to pick the route they picked, is there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, again, we thought, or the legislature thought, and I would have echoed that sentiment, that the sustainable forest would be enough of enhancement for them to enter into it, and which is currently paying about $4.50 per acre, which in some cases even exceeds the tax burden of some of these properties. Potlatch made the conscious decision to not go in so that they could lease all these properties for hunting purposes. Yeah. Now, the problem we have as a supervisor of the assessment process is, On the one hand, if you think about Potlatch leasing out the lands, you could argue that it's an instance where it might be a seasonal recreational classification, which would, as you mentioned, incorporate the state general tax. It gets harder on smaller tracts where you have individuals who are enrolled in the Sustainable Forest Program, who are practicing forest management plans, but they also post signs on their property restricting hunting. And if it's less than 1,920 acres, which all privately owned lands enrolled within the Sustainable Forest Program is, they can post their lands, and or they can rent their lands or do whatever they want with them, and they'd be enrolled in the program. Potlatch does create, the use of their lands does create a problem, I'm sure locally. From our perspective, looking at all lands, we have, as you mentioned, the code of conduct, we can't really differentiate between the person who owns 640 acres and posts it or rents it to another person, an individual, that is enrolled in the Sustainable Forest Program, and those who don't.
Maybe you need another class.
That really clears things up. Thank you.
Well, if you're satisfied.
No.
Representative Brad.
Well, Mr. Chair, we are talking, maybe I don't understand, but aren't we talking about private property? So I mean, you can't really have a classification differently addressing whether somebody allows people on their private property or whether they don't. I mean, it is private property. Maybe I'm not understanding why we're frustrated with the fact that not letting people on there.
Mr. Chair.
Because,
and I didn't know what it was called, but I knew there was a special tax break if they kept the land open to the public, because they own, you know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of acres.
And that's the timber?
Yes. Now that it was changed a few years ago with the Sustainable Forest Act, you know, it's, I guess, a little bit different, but they're getting all private property, right. Mr. Chair, but they're getting a better break than the person next to them merely because, and it's for the same exact usage. There's a hunting shack on them.
Why are they getting the break? That's not following.
That's exactly what I'm asking. I guess the rationale is that because they have large acreage, you know, you get a break. And because I got, you know, 96 acres of timber with moose and fishers and timber wolves and everything, like, well, timber wolves, but anyway, running through it, you know, I should get the same as them. I got 200-year-old, I got 350-year-old yellow birch I'll show you on my property, older than the nation. So I should really get the same tax break as Bob actually.
Representative Brad?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I thank you for the description, too. I guess I'm trying to compare, maybe not necessarily potlatch, but if you make all land that is somewhat used for hunting, whether it's letting your brother-in-law hunt on there for $100 or rented for $1,000, into seasonal recreational property, you'd be reclassifying a heck of a lot of land out there that might incidentally be used for hunting. So I guess I'm trying to set aside the timber classification for a minute. I'm trying to figure out how you would, I mean, if you go in and take vacant parcels of land and identify them as seasonal recreation, then you have to do that with a seasonal rec property of another 40 down the road to be consistent. So then you're reclassifying a heck of a lot of pieces of land, I would think.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bob, that's my point. He said because there was no trespassing signs and activity in a cabin, it was classified as seasonal rec property.
Is there?
But on these other ones, there's not going to be cabins on them, or hunting shacks, whatever you want to call them, and they're not going to be seasonal rec property because they're owned by Potlatch because they got, you know, 30,000 or 50,000 or whatever it is, acres in St. Louis County. Right, Mel?
Can someone straighten us out?
Mr. Chair, I think what's getting a little bit clouded here is a comparison of properties that are improved with a structure, whether it's a hunting camp or a trailer they pull in and leave there for year after year, whatever, versus vacant land. I believe that the situation that Representative Rukamina is talking about, the adjoining property likely has a hunting cabin on it, which would then compel the assessor to classify it as seasonal recreational residential. If that adjoining property was void of any structures, all right, and let's say that owner leased the hunting rights out to the same group that leases from Potlatch, so they've got a block ownership, both parcels would be classified as timber. It's the structure that makes the difference in terms of the classification.
But, Mr. Chair, that's what I asked at the beginning of the conversation. There's hunting shacks and no trespassing signs going up on Potlatch's land. So then why aren't they the same as Marty Lullinan's land next door? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if the Potlatch land has a hunting shack on it, in other words, they've leased it out so that a person can keep a hunting shack there, then it will be classified as seasonal recreational residential.
Okay. Well, then that's fine. No, that's okay. What I asked in the beginning, and I didn't get the same answer. So you're going to be doing that then up there, Mr. Chair, Mr. Hines.
Yes. Well, I believe we are.
But if you're renting land, isn't that a little bit, that's not a different classification than seasonal rent? Well, that's what I was. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, you know, we sort of, you know, when we keep trying to solve problems as property tax administrators and you as legislators, we find ourselves creating new problems. Many years ago, we used to have a vacant land class, which had a prohibitively high class rate. Mm-hmm. And in those days, there was a requirement that to get to seasonal recreational residential classification, you had to have an actual structure or residential. Within that definition, you had to have a residential use. So the department, prior to the time I was with the department, required there to be a cabin on there, or they had to camp on the property, and there had to be an actual campsite, hence the residential use. When we got rid of the vacant land class, and we put in the potential value class, to class property based upon its highest and best use, then that sort of opened the all these issues about if the highest and best use of a property that was leased by Potlatch was now seasonal recreational, or if it continued to be timber. And that varied from property to property. Representative kept referring to signs of property. I guess I certainly would never advocate classifying property based on signage of the property. Mm-hmm. Clearly, if you have a seasonal structure on the property, it's a seasonal property. One of the problems that this Potlatch lines are creating is Potlatch, I don't believe, for the most part, allows persons to erect a structure on there. They can use the land. They have exclusive use of the land for hunting purposes. But if they, I believe, according to the Potlatch representatives I talked to, they can bring a camper or a trailer in, but they have to remove it at the end of the season. But within that, then, the assessor is forced to try to determine what the highest and best use of that property is. Is the highest and best use the timber management employed by Potlatch and other like property owners, or is the highest and best use seasonal, or is the existing use? And this guy will actually speak to some of those issues further on in the report.
Well, I think it's the Senate's fault. But anyway. Any other questions for members? Sounds like you have your work cut out for you. Is this... So this is done?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so continue then.
Okay. As you can see, based on our discussion for the last half hour or so, this method of classifying unimproved property leads to questions surrounding the lack of uniformity of assessor's classification. And instances where nearly identical properties are classified differently from one portion of the county to the next and from one county to the next. The potential classifications also have different classification rates, and some of the classifications pay the state general levy. Thus, even if market values on two nearly identical pieces of property are very similar, they can generate very different tax amounts. It is important to point out that taxpayers do not get to choose the classification of their properties based on the most beneficial classification rate, since the classification rates are often very fluid and often change over time. For this reason, we've instructed assessors not to consider the tax implications when classifying the property. It should be classified according to its current use or its most probable highest and best use under current law. Mm-hmm. As part of our analysis for this report, we conducted a survey of all counties in the state, and we asked how they would classify property under different scenarios. Based on our analysis and the survey results, we've identified four primary issues that need to be addressed. The first issue is the current method of classifying vacant land. This has, we believe, has led to a lack of uniformity in classification among similar properties. It is our recommendation that we would like the legislature to implement a new classification of property for rural wooded vacant land. This would significantly decrease the lack of uniformity, and it would simplify the assessor's job. It should be emphasized that this new classification would not include wooded property that is properly classified as agricultural property pursuant to Minnesota Statute 273.13. Prior to adopting a new classification, there are several issues that need to be explored and analyzed. First of all, the committee would like to recommend a minimum size of 10 acres for the proposed rural vacant land classification. It is our opinion that unimproved property of less than 10 acres should be continued to be classified according to its most probable use. And this will depend on the assessor's judgment and the knowledge of the local market. This should be easier for the assessor to determine if the tracts are over 40 acres. We also request that for those tracts under 10 acres in size, the legislature change the language that specifies that the assessor classify the property according to its highest and best use and change it to the most probable use. The second issue we must consider is that of the state general levy. Currently, seasonal rec property in general makes up only 5% of the state general levy. In addition, the value of unimproved property that is over 10 acres in size that is currently classified as seasonal rec property is considered to be minimal when compared to the total value of improved property that is classified as seasonal rec. Therefore, we believe any tax shifts would be minimal, but we would recommend further analysis of this. The third issue we need to discuss if we adopt the new rural vacant land classification would be that of unplatted property. It is our recommendation that only unplatted property be considered to be eligible for the proposed rural vacant land classification. Typically, the platting process signals development in the area, and we do not feel it would be proper to include that in the classification. The fourth issue is that of structures. We believe that minor non-residential structures, such as tool sheds or storage buildings, some of which are typically found on SFIA, Sustainable Forest Incentive Act managed property. We feel that the existence of these structures should not preclude a property from being classified as rural vacant land if we adopt the new classification. However, if there are any permanent structures that are used residentially or seasonally, it indicates that there is an actual use of the property, and that would preclude the property from being included in the proposed rural vacant land classification. The classification rate, we did not recommend a classification rate for this proposed rural vacant land class. The current possible classifications of vacant land, as well as their corresponding classification rates, are summarized on page 7 of the report, so you can take a look at those. In addition to the proposed rural vacant land classification, we noticed based on our survey results that assessors are currently very hesitant to split classify properties where they have one identifiable use and there is also a large amount of excess land. For example, the 240-acre parcels that Mel had spoke about earlier, where one property was used as a residential homestead and the second 40 was vacant. We would recommend that second 40 be classified in the new proposed rural vacant land classification. Split classification of a property is a concept and assessment that occurs when there are two or more distinct uses of a property. In such cases, the assessor must use separate classifications for each different use of the property. The assessor must then distribute the total market value between those two classifications or more. Based on the survey results, most assessors are hesitant to split classify either on a contiguous land mass or a parcel basis. This hesitation is largely due to the complications of calculating limited market values and property taxes on properties with two or more classifications of land. In addition, there are no clear guidelines indicating when a use is incidental to the primary use of the property or when the use becomes significant enough to warrant a split classification.
Okay, we're going to have to finish here in a minute or two because we're going to make it to session, so
okay.
If you care to continue or you can wrap it up now and then we'll see about maybe discussing it further down the road.
Okay, I'll just finish with the recommendation of the second issue there. Establishing the new rural vacant land classification would allow assessors to classify a parcel with a single use according to that use and classify the excess land in accordance with the proposed rural vacant land classification. It should be emphasized that in no way do we suggest that improved properties with two or more uses be held to the 40-acre minimum size. The committee would also like to implement a minimum acreage requirement for split classifying a property by limiting it to parcels that exceed 40 acres or a government lot, which is slightly more or less than 40 acres. For example, a taxpayer who owns two contiguous parcels, each consisting of 40 acres, on one of the parcels there is a cabin that is used seasonally by the owner. In this case, we would recommend that the 40-acre parcel with the cabin be classified as seasonal recreational, and the vacant land parcel be classified according to the proposed rural vacant land classification. If there is no law change, the assessor would most likely classify both parcels as seasonal recreational property because it is the only use on the first parcel of the land and is the most probable use of the second parcel of the land. In the absence of a new rural land classification, the Department of Revenue will attempt to draft specific guidelines on split classification of those types of property. And we can end it there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions for members? Well, thank you very much. It's pretty thorough. I think we're done then. We are adjourned.